Welcome to the Danico Tart Audio Network. This is a podcast where we're talking about real estate, specifically financing. You're going to hear me say that all again in a second because I'm outside walking the dog Ghost. But this is a little intro I wanted to record just to let you guys know. If it's a little windy, that's why. I'm outside walking the boy. And I'm not going to cut this one up. I'm just going to leave everything in. And it's going to be really raw and unedited. And so enjoy. Home buyers and home sellers and agents in general, welcome to the Danico Tart Podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about financing when it comes to real estate. I'm going to be going over basic concept and terminologies, things that you might want to know, and other financing instruments, financing methods, conventional loans, financing, obviously, FHA loans, USDA rural program loans, authorized loans, adjustable rate loans, bridge loans, and more. So make sure you guys are tuned in. If you guys are going to be taking notes, go ahead and get that ready because this is going to be a very informative episode of the podcast. I'm outside walking my dog right now, and I think this is going to be the way that I do these podcasts from now on because it gives me a way to get outside, you know, walk my dog for one, get some fresh air, get the mind moving, get the brain working, and it's a different setting. And so, you know, get myself out a bit more. Maybe you guys are listening to this podcast when you're on a drive. Maybe you're on a run. Or, you know, maybe you're just ready to learn. This way, Ghost. Come on. This way, buddy. And you guys will see and you guys will hear the interactions that I have with my constituents in my neighborhood. And so, yeah, it'll be fun. I'm actually going to let my dog just walk because if I don't, it's probably not going to be the best as far as me trying to keep him, you know, just on the... Wait. All right, buddy. Go have fun. All right, but here we go. So, first, we got points. One loan point is equal to 1% of the borrower's loan amount. Lenders may charge loan points or... they're also called loan origination fees as compensation for processing a new mortgage loan. Those fees are typically between 1 and 3% and can't be more than 3% of the loan value typically. And these fees may be negotiable between the lender and the borrower. Borrowers may choose to pay discount points at closing to permanently reduce the loan's interest rate. So 1 point, like I said, is equal to 1% of the loan amount. So if a lender charges 2 points on a, say, $250,000 loan, the cost to purchase a discount would be $250,000 times 0.2 or 2%, and that would be equal to $5,000. A buy down is a interest prepayment at closing to temporarily reduce rates, usually for a period of 1 to 3 years. An example of a buy down would be a 3-2-1 buy down where the interest rate is 3% interest rate reduction 1 year, 2% year two, and 1% year three. The interest rate returns in full in year four. LTV, otherwise known as loan to value ratio, is the ratio of the loan amount to the property value, and stated another way, is a mathematical calculation that you would do. But I won't do that on the podcast because there's really no, there is value in it, but there's a lot more value in me doing that on a YouTube video. And so, but if you are curious, I will say, since I have my notes in front of me here, sales price or appraised value, whichever is lower. So that's what they're going to use when it comes to the loan to value ratio. They're going to pick, like I said, the sales price or the appraised price of the house. And so an example would be a $160,000 loan on a $200,000 house, gives you an LTV of 80% because $160,000 divided by $200,000 equals 0.8, otherwise known as 80%. And so stated another way,
A 20% down payment on a $200,000 loan is equal to $40,000. And that math would be $200,000 times 0.2 equals $40,000. This gives you an LTV of 80%. And by you, that means the borrower. Lenders use LTV to determine required down payments when initially writing mortgage loans or homeowners, or when homeowners apply for an equity loan or a home equity line of credit. So I'll repeat that one. Lenders use LTV to determine required down payment amounts when initially writing mortgage loans or when homeowners apply for a home equity or home equity line of credit. LTV may also be a factor in the loan's interest rate, payment, PMI requirement, and loan type. Moving on to interest, that was all under the points section. So like I said, moving on to interest. Interest is a fee paid back to the lender for the use of its money. The amount of interest paid with each mortgage payment typically decreases over the life of the mortgage. Interest rates are stated as an annual percentage. APR, or annual percentage rate, is a measure of both the interest rate and other fees associated with a mortgage loan. Lenders typically lock in interest rates for a period of no more than 90 days. While the exact period is up to the lender, if the closing process takes more than 90 days, borrowers should expect that they may face an interest rate change. So, you know, like that said pretty clearly, if the closing from start to finish takes more than 90 days, then people who are obtaining a loan for that home should expect a rate change, because at that point, the market has probably fluctuated in some degree up, down. You know, it might not be a big change, but there probably is some change in accordance, you know, that's needed. Now we have PMI, or private mortgage insurance. Lenders may require private mortgage insurance on conventional loans when the down payment is less than 20% and the loan-to-value ratio is in excess of 80%. So in excess, they mean you're not borrowing when the loan-to-value ratio is in excess of 80%. So they're basically saying you're borrowing too much money. So loans with the LTV of in excess of 80% don't conform to Fannie Mae / Freddie Mac guidelines, so lenders may require PMI to offset the risk. I skipped a bullet point here. PMI protects the lender in case of borrower default, and lenders must terminate PMI when the principal balance is scheduled to reach 78% of the original property value, or when the mortgage loan reaches its original scheduled amortization point. So like I was saying a minute ago, if you're borrowing too much money over 80%, they're, you know, when it's less than 80%, then it's going to have lenders require PMI. And once you get usually over 20% of equity into that, you know, home, then you're able to get some PMI off in some scenarios, not all scenarios, but borrowers may request PMI termination when the principal balance drops below 80% of the loan balance. Depending on market conditions and property updates, this permits borrowers to remove PMI earlier in the mortgage loan term. In the mortgage loan term, not long term. All right, insurance or PTI. All right, next we have financing instruments. Financing instruments are executed / signed when a borrower receives a mortgage loan. These instruments include a promissory note and a security note. Now I'm going to explain what both of those are. A promissory note is the borrower's promise to repay the mortgage loan. These notes are negotiable instruments, which means they can be transferred to another holder. Promissory notes are almost always accompanied by a security instrument. that pledges the finance property as collateral for the mortgage loan and gives lenders the right to foreclose if the borrower defaults on the mortgage loan. The security instrument may either be a deed of trust or a mortgage. And now I'm going to explain what the deed of trust is. That is the deed of trust, or it's also called a trust deed, involves three parties: the trustor, who is the borrower, the beneficiary, who is the lender, and the trustee, who is an independent third party who holds the deed of trust. States that use a deed of trust as a primary security instrument are referred to as title theory states, because the title, which means, because the lender slash trustee holds legal title, sorry, I couldn't find my line right there, to the property until the mortgage loan is paid in full. I'll repeat that line. States that use a deed of trust as a primary security instrument are referred to as title theory states because the lender slash trustee holds legal title to the property until the mortgage loan is paid off. Borrowers who hold equitable title, which means that they have possessory rights and have the right to obtain legal title once they're paid off. So just to kind of take a breather here and kind of go over what we just talked about, we're going over financing instruments and the promissory note and the deed of trust slash trust deed. Like I said, just a few very important bullet points. The deed of trust or trust deed involves three parties: the trustor, who is a person who is borrowing the money, the beneficiary, who is the person who is lending out the money, and the trustee, who is an independent third party that holds the deed of trust. This is important because there are two types of states. There's lien theory and then there's title theory. So we just talked about title theory, where a state that uses a deed of trust as a primary security instrument are referred to as title theory states because the lender slash trustee holds legal title to the property until the mortgage is paid off. We'll talk about lien theory a little bit later in the podcast. Ghost, please don't go too far. Come on, buddy. See, man, this is why I don't let him off the leash. Hey, Ghost, come here. He's gone. He's absolutely gone. Now I gotta go run and get him. Hey, come here. Ghost, stop. This is why, damn it, Ghost. Get out there, go. He just wanders off, man. Just goes too far off by himself. Doesn't have any self-control. This is why he has a leash. Hey, come here. Ghost, come here. Sit down. Dogs are bad, man. I love them, but they're bad. Sometimes. It doesn't sound like he's being bad, but when he's not being obedient, that's bad. Because that could hurt him at the end of the day. But, so. Go. Alrighty, so moving back on to continue the podcast and where we were. A mortgage involves two parties, like I said before, the lender and the borrower. States that use a mortgage as the security instrument are referred to as lien theory states because the mortgage places a lien against the property it secures. The lender holds the lien and the person borrowing the money holds legal title to the property. If foreclosure becomes needed, the lender may have to use a judicial foreclosure process, which means the lender must go through the courts to foreclose on the house. If the mortgage document includes a power of sale clause, however, the lender may use non-judicial foreclosure process. Mortgage lenders issue a satisfaction or release of mortgage to acknowledge the borrower's loan payoff, security instrument and clauses. So a defiance clause orders the lender to orders the lender or trustee to immediately release full title to the borrower once the loan is paid in full. An acceleration clause makes the entire debt due immediately if there's borrow default. And a due on sale clause, also known as an alienation clause, requires the person borrowing the money to repay the loan when transferring ownership to another person. And a prepayment penalty clause is exactly what it sounds like. If you pay off your house early, you are going to have a penalty for that, because that's usually in a case where, you know, if you do that, then the person who is lending you the money is not going to be making as much as they would make off of the interest, and so they try to recoup some of that in a prepayment clause. So that's all of the financing instruments and, you know, security instrument clauses and whatnot. Now moving on to types of loans. So very first and foremost, we have the, or one of the most well-known loans, a conventional. And those conventional loans are not government insured or guaranteed. Lenders view conventional loans as some of the most secure because they may require a down payment of 20%, thus reducing the LTV to 80%. Lenders view conventional loans as some of the most secure because they may require a down payment of 20%, thus reducing the LTV to 80%. I just read that. Conventional loans can be conforming or non-conforming. The FHFA, or Federal Housing Financing Agency, imposes loan limits on the amount home buyers may borrow. A conforming loan meets the loan limit and other criteria that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac set. Lenders can sell conforming loans. There's a lot of dirt right here that I'm stepping in. Lenders can sell conforming loans to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. Homebuyers who wish to borrow more than a loan limit must make up the difference through a larger down payment or finance with a jumbo loan. A conventional loan that fails to meet Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac guidelines for credit scores, LTV, and or loan amount is considered non-conforming. Lenders may still fund non-conforming loans, but will usually charge a higher interest rate and or require mortgage insurance to minimize the risk. And I will say, I am not obviously reading off of my notes. These are notes that I got from my exam where I took my real estate license. So if you guys are wondering where this information is coming from and why it's so good, why it's so valuable, then there you go. This is directly from PSI, who issues the state test to become your real estate agent. So next we got a jumbo loan, or do we have a conventional loan that fails me? All right, moving on to a jumbo loan, which is a conventional non-conforming loan because it exceeds conforming loan limits but meets other conforming loan requirements. So just to try to break that down a little bit, in my head, it's going to be exceeding the loan limits of the price of the house that they're going to be able to, you know, give you money for, but it conforms in other ways. So that's that page. We got a little bit more, maybe a lot, but a no, I'm just watching my dog poop right here. Sorry, unprofessional. Excuse me. But we have the Federal Housing Administration, or FHA, insures lenders against loss in case of borrower default. FHA borrowers must pay a minimum down payment of 3.5%. That's one of the most, in my opinion, well-known common real estate facts. If you're getting an FHA loan, how much you're going to pay? Probably 3.5%. So, Ghost, are you still trying to take a doo-doo-doo, bro? Like, what are you doing? He's walking. I think he is. Okay, VA guaranteed loans. Sorry, guys, I'm just watching my dog here. He's trying to make me nervous. But VA guarantee loans, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs guarantees loans made to qualifying veterans. The VA loans do not require down payments or mortgage insurance, but have no prepayment penalties. VA loan eligibility depends on the length and type of service, but in general are available to military members who have served 181 days active duty or 3 months during wartime. Most VA lenders adhere to conventional conforming loan limits. This doesn't limit the amount that borrowers may borrow, but borrowers whose loans exceed these limits must make a down payment. The VA guarantees up to a quarter of the loan limit amount should the buyer default. This minimizes risk for lenders to make up for the no down payment VA loan structure. And that's everything we have on VA loans. Next, we got USDA/rural loan programs. So, that's poopy. No. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, or USDA, offers some state and local mortgage loan programs. The USDA Farm Service Agency, or FSA, offers direct guaranteed loans to farmers and ranchers and for rural housing. Congressional appropriation funds these loans. So, rural development loans are government loans specifically for family farms and rural home financing. They offer a longer payback period to reduce monthly payments. FSA loans can be up to 100% of the purchase price set for 33 years and provide loan guarantees for up to 95% of the loss of principal and interest. Excuse me. And that's everything we have on USDA/rural loans. Next, we have amortized loans. An amortized loan is one in which the loan principal is paid down over the life of the loan. So, if we're being honest, almost every loan is like an amortized loan. There's only one kind of loan, and that would be a balloon payment that is not amortized. And there actually may be more than one. I just only know the balloon payment, so, you know, if that's true, forgive me. But a fully amortized loan will be paid in full after the last scheduled loan payment, or sooner if the borrower makes additional principal payments during the loan term. The monthly principal and interest amount is the same each month. The principal portion of the payment increases each month, while the interest portion decreases. A partially amortized loan includes partial amortization over the loan term and a balloon payment at the end of the term where the borrower pays off the loan in one lump sum. So, like I just said, balloon payment is where you're either paying very little or not very much at all up front. And then At the end of the loan term, you're paying a balloon payment, whatever that amount may be, at the end of the term to satisfy the lender. So next we got adjustable rate mortgages. I think my dog's tired, guys. Come on, buddy. We're almost, not really, but we're getting there. Adjustable rate mortgages and adjustable rate mortgage, or ARM, is one in which the interest rate fluctuates based on some selected economic index. And, you know, forgive me for not remembering exactly at this moment, but like I said, some selected economic index. Rates adjust their index rates. Rate adjustments are based on index rates, such as London Interbank Offered or LIBOR, which from lenders determine their margins and rate charge per month. AMRs typically have a lower interest rate for an initial period of 1 to several years. A special type of AMR is a fixed/adjustable rate note. It's a legal agreement that permits the borrower to convert a fixed rate mortgage to an AMR under certain conditions. And negative amortization may be experienced with some AMRs. This occurs when a payment fails to cover the amount of interest due. When this happens, the difference between interest owed and the interest paid is added to the loan's principal. That's everything we have on adjustable rate mortgages, or AMRs. Now we have bridge loans. A bridge loan, or a swing loan is another name for it, is a temporary short-term loan that provides funds until buyers can obtain permanent financing. Some borrowers who qualify financially may obtain a bridge loan when their current home hasn't yet sold, but they are ready to purchase a new home. The bridge loan basically covers the down payment. A bridge loan is typically secured by the borrower's existing home. And lenders may structure the bridge loan so that borrowers make only interest payments during the loan term and then pay off the entire loan when the previous home sales, when the previous home sale closes. Owner financing. That was the end of bridge loans. And yeah, we're moving on to owner financing. Installment and land contracts for deeds, or contract for deed. A land contract or contract for deed requires the buyer to make an installment payment to the seller for the property purchase. The seller retains the title while the buyer gets equitable title. And equitable title is basically just equity in that house, you know, your percentage in that house. That's being obviously documented as you're paying it off. And so, a purchase money mortgage is a loan a seller issues to the buyer as part of the purchase transaction. This typically occurs in situations where the buyer cannot qualify for a mortgage through traditional means. With a wraparound mortgage, the seller holds a mortgage that wraps the new buyer's mortgage around the seller's existing mortgage. The seller continues to make payments on the first mortgage, and the buyer makes payments to the seller on the wraparound mortgage. Now, that may be one of the more confusing things that you guys hear in today's podcast, so if you need to, play that back, but you might not need to because I'm going to read it again for you. With a wraparound mortgage, the seller holds a mortgage that wraps the new buyer's mortgage around the seller's existing mortgage. The seller continues to make payments on the first mortgage, and the buyer makes payments to the seller on the wraparound mortgage. That's the end of, you know, different kinds of mortgages and whatnot. Now we're moving on to lending and financing. Lending process, application through closing first. So there's a lot here, and, you know, it might not all get read, but I'm going to read you guys the important parts. And so follow along here. Lenders may pre-qualify borrowers based on borrower provided information, not lender verified information. When the application materials are complete, the lender submits the loan package to underwriting. When the loan is approved, the buyer is cleared to go to closing. Most lenders require that borrowers maintain current fire and hazard insurance policies Most lenders require that borrowers maintain current hazard and fire insurance policies and that the policy name the lender as a co-insured party. At closing, the buyer signs all the loan and real estate docs. The lender funds the loan when the seller has conveyed the property. Lender funds and buyer funds combine to pay off the seller's existing mortgage loan, pay the buyer's closed expenses, and provide the balance due to the seller. Keep in mind, if a mortgage property is being sold, the alienation or due on sale clause gives the lender the right to declare the entire amount due. Or allowing the buyer to assume the loan. So, you know, just be aware of that kind of thing in your contract. Hey, this dog keeps sniffing poo-poo. The real estate mortgage industry functions through collaboration between the primary and secondary mortgage markets. The primary mortgage market provides loans to borrowers or mortgagors and is made up of several lender types: commercial banks, saving and loan associations, credit unions, mortgage brokers, and mortgage bankers. Now I'm going to go through and explain each of those people to you and those types of roles. So, first we got commercial banks. They are national banks that offer consumer and business loans for resale on the secondary mortgage markets. Next we have saving and loan associations. Those take saving deposits and make loans, very simple. Credit unions, I have a membership at a credit union, you know, just gonna put that out there, why not? They are member-based cooperatives that take deposits, offer saving vehicles, and provide credit for auto and home loans. Next we got mortgage brokers. They match consumers with lenders, they don't find loans. Then we have mortgage bankers. They make loans using in-house processors and underwriters. That was all five of those. So then we have the next line that says, lenders in the primary mortgage market put together packages of conforming loans and sell them to the secondary mortgage market to free up funds that provide additional consumer loans. This way goes. Secondary mortgage market payers purchase lender loan packages and repackage them into mortgage-backed securities, MBSs. They sell the MBSs to investors. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Farmer Mac, and Ginnie Mae and lending institutions that buy loans from other lenders and investors make up the secondary market. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are government-sponsored enterprises, which is a privately held corporation that has a public purpose. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac purchase mortgage loan packages from lenders. Ginnie Mae guarantees MBSs that are made up of government-insured or guaranteed loans. Farmer Mac functions in the secondary market by buying qualified agricultural loans from lenders. This way goes. All right, we're in the home stretch here. Trigger terms and ads that will require. Excuse me. Let me just make sure we have some context here. So like I said, we're done with all those other ones as far as, you know, secondary mortgage market, MBSs and whatnot. So moving on to financing and credit laws and rules. So number one, We got Truth and Lending, which is an act that was initiated in 1968, and it requires lenders to disclose credit terms and conditioning when advertising. And, you know, that's just a very basic and needed thing in the marketing world. So then we have trigger terms that are in ads that would require the full disclosure of all terms, included down payment, payment amount, number of payments, and interest rate. And basically, trigger terms, when you have a advertisement, you don't need to put certain things in there unless you have certain trigger terms in there, therefore requiring you to put in said information, such as, like I just said, down payment, number of payments, interest rate, and the amount. And so as long as you can avoid putting in those trigger words in your, say, you know, advertisement, if you're a lender, or whatever it is, if you're an agent, then you won't have to put in those extra specifications. So Regulation Z requires mortgage lenders to follow TILA disclosure requirements for real estate advertisements that include credit terms. Then we have RESPA. RESPA is Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act of 1974. The Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act of 1974 is a consumer protection statute designed to protect homebuyers from unscrupulous lending and settlement practices. The Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act of 2010 handed RESPA the responsibility to the Consumer Protection Finance Bureau, or CPFB. Licensees are prohibited from paying or receiving a fee slash kickback or anything of value based on referring customers or clients to a settlement service provider. So that would be me in that scenario. I am not able to receive a, you know, referral fee or kickback or anything of value based on referring customers or clients to a settlement service provider. Then we got the Equal Credit Opportunity right here. This is an act that was initiated in 1974, and it prohibits lenders from making credit unavailable or offering less favorable terms based on protected class statutes. That would be race, color, religion, national origin slash sex, marital status, or income source, versus credit worthiness. And so you can't take any of those things and then try and use them to not give anybody X amount of dollars when it comes to them applying for a loan. This dog has me going through a whole ass tree, man. So I don't want to read over the stuff that's not really necessary as far as, you know, just completely needed for the agents, for the buyers and the sellers out there. Because there's some stuff in here that they did not even test you on. And it's not to say you won't need it, but it is to say that you don't need it. So we're going to move on here to the final page. We're going to talk about underwriting, debt ratios, credit scoring, and credit history. And then we're going to, you know, move on and have a jolly old day. It's the day after Christmas. It's a very nice day here in Michigan. And there's no snow on the ground. But nonetheless, yeah, we're going to keep on moving forward. Keep making some content. So inflated appraisals. An appraiser secretly works with a borrower and provides a misleading appraisal to report to the lender. Usury is lending money at an excessive slash illegal rate. So, you know, if someone's lending you money with a 13 or a 17% credit score, that's usury. That's illegal. That is a problem. Credit cards, most states have laws designed to protect consumers from exorbitant fees and interest rates by limiting what lenders charge to reasonable amounts. And notice they said most states there, so I'm I would be surprised if all states do, if all states don't, but I, you know, this is America. Credit cards, retail installment contracts, and consumer leases are typically exempt from usury laws. You got underwriting. Primary factors in loan underwriting include income, debt ratio, credit score, and credit history. Debt ratios next. Loan underwriters analyze the person's debt, who's borrowing the money, their capacity, and their collateral. Come on, buddy. You're walking hella slow. They review loan documentation to determine the borrower's ability to repay the loan capacity. Ensure that the property value is adequate to support the loan. That's the collateral, and verify the borrower's financial ratios. And that's called credit. Lenders and underwriters want to see solid property values, strong buyer credit scores, and a steady credit and employment history. Underwriters will calculate two ratios, the housing ratio and the debt ratio. The housing ratio is the borrower's projected monthly housing expense divided by their income. The required ratio will vary depending on the loan type and lender. Alrighty, so the debt ratio is the total of the buyer's debt obligations divided by their income. After loan package analysis, the underwriter will recommend application approval or denial, or may request more documentation. Credit scoring. Underwriters will receive borrower credit scores to ensure that they fall within the ranges outlined for a given loan product. Credit score requirements will vary depending on whether the borrower is seeking a conventional FHA or VA loan. Credit score impacts interest rates and other loan requirements and other loan terms. Sorry. Conventional loans typically require credit scores of 620 and above. FHA borrowers must have a minimum credit score of 580 to qualify for a 3.5% down payment. People with credit scores between 500 and 579 may have to put down as much as 10%. Borrowers with higher credit scores and other compensating factors such as cash reserves or additional income sources may qualify for higher front-end and back-end ratio loan ratios. And last but not least, we got credit history. So underwriters also look at credit history, including several factors: length of time borrowers have maintained a credit account, the length of time you've had good credit, your late payment history, the amount of credit you have available to you, and the types of credit you have available to you. So whether it's bank credit, credit card companies, car credit, mortgage loans, this is what they're going to look at and determine whether or not, you know, you have a versatile versus just a good overall credit, credit history. And so that has been financing in the industry, in the real estate industry. You know, first of many podcasts. This one was a little bit chaotic, guys. I'm sorry, because I got my dog here. He kind of went off on a, you know, little adventure for a minute. So I'm sorry about that little thing right there. You know, I had to go get him. But other than that, this went pretty smooth. And I think that I'm going to keep doing these as long as you guys like them. Any interactions I have with people, you know, if they have questions about anything real estate, I'll keep them in here. And so make sure you guys like and subscribe. No, don't pee in the trash can. Make sure you guys like and subscribe the podcast. I really appreciate it. And I'll see you guys in the next one. Peace out, and go sell some houses, buy some houses, and do what you gotta do. Get that business done. Have a good day, guys. Hard to turn this shit off, bro.